Okay, everybody, good evening. Welcome to tonight's lecture. Tonight we continue our series, The Breakaways, looking now across the Atlantic at one of the important breakaways that takes place in the Americas. We looked last time at the city of Hamburg. Tonight we're looking at New York. Next month we'll be looking at London, and then we'll be with July with Charleston. Now I've been getting comments on some Facebook pages of people questioning my selection of these particular places. As you know, people there are quite supportive of each other on social media. What we're actually trying to do here is to paint a picture, is to understand what was taking place within the Western Jewish world in the early 1800s. It was a time of great change. We spoke, you know, last term about the publications that came out during this time and how people are responding to, you know, conversion and to assimilation and to issues of emancipation and reform. And so we saw that kind of in terms of the literary output of people during those times. But really what they're responding to on some level are these events, right? Are these kind of cataclysmic events that are taking place in Western Jewry during these years. We mentioned Hamburg is 1818. This is gonna be 1825 tonight. London is, I think it's 1840. Charleston's 1841, right? So all of these things are happening in close order. And as we mentioned, all of these are happening in the context or somehow relating in some way to the SMB, right? To the Spanish and Portuguese community. Because at this time, when we think of Western Jewry, not entirely, we know there's Ashkenazi community in London and there are some in other places, but the overall picture, kind of take the Americas into account in Western Europe, right? There's this very strong Spanish and Portuguese presence. Many places only have one synagogue. That's going to be the case of New York tonight. And that synagogue is Spanish and Portuguese. And so when we talk about these breakaways, they're going to cause major disruption to the kind of status quo, to the Spanish and Portuguese communities. Those communities are going to be responding to these challenges. Now we saw in Hamburg, it was essentially a Ashkenazi movement that was heavily influenced by their impression of what Sephardic Jewry was, right? Looking back, what they imagined had been in Spain, and they lifted from their pronunciation of Hebrew, and they took certain Sephardic prayers, and they even hired a Sephardic Kazan, right? They did all these things to be more Sephardic, because they saw that as being a more perfect or ideal form of Judaism. And so when they went reform, right, they were reforming from Ashkenaz to, in a sense, adopt more Sephardic practices, and also making certain alterations as well, as we saw making some edits within their prayer books and so on. When I first presented this lecture, I think the presumption was, and I think this is the way kind of people think about it, is that this was all gonna be really about reform, right? That this is all about the turmoil going on with reform. What we're gonna see in these is that reform is not always the issue that's taking place, and it's not always about Sephardic, because again, Hamburg is essentially Ashkenaz. They're just modeling themselves on what they imagine Sephardic should be. And in some places it's Sephardic Jews doing it, in some places it's Ashkenazi Jews doing it, but because of the nature of the Jewish community at that time, it all has a big impact on the Sephardic community, on the Spanish and Portuguese community. Now, in London, as I mentioned, there's a Sephardic and an Ashkenazi. However, in New York, that's not the case. The community in New York dates itself back to 1654, when the Dutch arrived, New Amsterdam. There was a group of Jews that came there shortly thereafter and settled and set up a community there. It becomes known as Sheeret Israel. Okay. And that's the only Jewish community in New York until you get to 1825. Okay, so you're dealing with a community that had been there for upwards of 200 years, meaning really it's been there for quite some time, and it's the only community that's been there. And we have to think about what that means, or understand what that means. Because if you are the only synagogue in town, then it's what historians call the Kehila model. There's one community, and it's not just the synagogue, it's not just the place you go to pray, and then you go someplace else to, you know, purchase your meat, and you go to another place to, you guys need to pull any of the trails, feel free to pull up the trails, where you go to have a mikveh, the circumcision, it's all not as separate institutions as we might think of today. It's all under one umbrella. It's all one thing. It's one of the things. There is no Judaism. There is no kind of Jewish experience outside of the synagogue itself, outside of Sheret Israel. And so what's going to take place, and we'll see this, is that it's not that every Jew in New York at that time is Sephardic. It's not the case at all. There's actually plenty of Ashkenazim that had been there. And since by the 1730s, the majority of the Jews in New York were Ashkenazi. We're not talking about a huge population, 500, 600 people, but the community is Spanish and Portuguese, right? That is what it is. It's almost at that time in America, the minhag of America is Spanish and Portuguese. So it doesn't make a difference what you've done privately or previously to coming to America. When you get there, you become a Spanish and Portuguese Jew. And so what you find oftentimes when reading the history of, let's say, Sheret Israel in the 1700s, historians will kind of refer to the Sephardim, and they'll mention names that when you read the history of Anglo-Jewry are identified as Ashkenazi Jews, right? Because it's their nephew, it's their cousin, it's, you know, whoever has gone there. And so what ends up happening is you have, you know, Ashkenazi Jews that, from an American Jewish history perspective, are thought of as Sephardic Jews because they're part of a Spanish and Portuguese community. That's the way that they pray. They end up marrying with the Sephardic families that are there, and they essentially become one. They become one community. Okay, and so that's a little bit the lay of the land in New York in the 18th century, right after the American Revolution. Right, it continues on that way, and then it essentially is a Sephardic community. New York and Charleston will be the two major Jewish communities in America after the American Revolution, until you get really kind of to the probably the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s. Charleston will decline. Philadelphia will grow as a Jewish community. Mark, look like you're here. Yeah, Philadelphia will grow as a Jewish community. But New York will always be an important community. Obviously, eventually New York will become the major community. And so we're going to look at what happens in New York, because what happens there is reflective of what's changing within the Jewish world, particularly in the Spanish and Portuguese world, but really within the Western Jewish world, because there's a great degree of upheaval that's taking place in the community. And explaining to some people what the kind of objective of this lecture series is I told them that what happens in these events essentially lay the framework for Judaism today, right? Now, obviously, there's going to be more population of peoples and the Holocaust and the State of Israel, but in terms of kind of the nature of Jewish life, a lot of it is going to be laid out in this time, because with the advent of Reform, you also get the invention of Orthodox, right? That idea of kind of the way that we think of the Jewish world today, of, you know, different communities and different types and maybe places that have multiple synagogues and they all do their own thing. That wasn't the way the world had been prior to this time. And so it's a time of great change, and it really is important for understanding the Jewish world as it is today. Okay, so that's the start over here. So let's talk a little bit about what will take place in the Jewish world, or in New York's Jewish world, that's going to lead to the events that we're talking about in tonight's lecture. So we're going to be talking about the breakaway that will be from Sheret Israel that will take place in 1825. But before we get there, we need to take a little bit of a look at what's happening before 1825, why it is that this actually happens, and it's going to have a lot to do with Europe. So we'll be kind of going back and forth a little bit with what's taking place. What we have over here is a plate that Sheret Israel produced for their 300th anniversary in 1954, and what it is a plate showing
their second synagogue building. They built their original synagogue in 1730, known as the Mill Street Synagogue. And then in 1818, they finished their second synagogue building, known as the Second Mill Street Synagogue. They simply built it in the location of where the first synagogue had been, but built a larger building. So we're going to be taking a look at what's actually happening, because this building is going to be important for understanding what takes place. What's going to happen, the reason they build a new synagogue building is interesting, because really, after the American Revolution, the Jewish community doesn't grow so much, in the same way that actually Anglo-Jewry doesn't actually grow so much in the years at the end of the 18th to very early 19th century. It's actually a time of great stability. It's something that we've mentioned in the past, that actually by the time you get to the 1820s or 1815 or so, the majority of the Jews living in England and in America have been born in England and America, right? We've kind of finished that age of that kind of movements in the middle 18th century, to the point that you have the majority of the population are native born, which, as we said, is going to be the last time that's going to be the case until you get to maybe this past generation in England and America, where again, you'll have the majority of people here having been born here. But once you get to the mid 1800s, all the way through till recent times, there's been so much immigration, Jewish immigration, from Central Europe and Eastern Europe and from different places into England and America, that majority of the population will actually not be native born until, you know, quite some time. So it, in a lot of ways, this moment in history is very similar to our own moment in history as well. So here we have it, that the community is there. It's after the American Revolution. They're doing okay. The community is, you know, stable, you know, kind of carrying on with things. But things are going to change in 1815. Does anybody know what happens in 1815?
Waterloo.
Waterloo, exactly. The fall of Napoleon. That is going to be in certain ways, a turning point for European Jewry, because Napoleon, with his expansion, brought equality to Jews, and that meant that Jews all of a sudden had opportunities in Central Europe in ways that they had never had before, and while that brought challenges and difficulties kind of to the historic structure of the Jewish community and to people's maybe commitment to Judaism and to the Jewish community, it obviously brought great opportunities, economic opportunities and social opportunities. With the fall of Napoleon, a lot of those rights were rescinded. And places that had previously treated Jews as second-class citizens or had limited, you know, their access to certain professions, they pull those back. They return to the original way that things had been. And so what ends up happening is you have a large amount of Jews in Central Europe who are really disillusioned at that point and decide it's time to leave. It's time to leave. And you'll start having people emigrate to America. And it's not going to only be Jews. There's going to be, you know, millions upon millions of Germans that will start moving to America. I think the number is in the middle of the 1800s, about 9 million that move during those. I mean, it's a huge population movement, notwithstanding the late 1800s when you'll have millions and millions more. I mean, there's so many people that will eventually go to America, and America's starting to expand west, and it's going to be a time again of a lot of change. And you'll start having this influx of people coming in to New York. And the community needs to accommodate these growing numbers of people, and so that's going to spur them to construct a new synagogue, which is going to hopefully be able to handle this growing number of people that have moved to New York. Now, it's true that many people who have moved to New York are not Sephardic, right? They're Ashkenazi Jews. They're coming from Central Europe. They're coming from what we might call Germany, but kind of that broader Central European area. But again, this is the synagogue there, and when they come, they simply are going to join the dominant, you know, the existing, pre-existing community, and they'll become part of the Spanish and Portuguese community. But again, these people are coming in poor. They've just arrived. It's obviously they're not going to integrate the way some of the Ashkenazi Jews that had moved in the 1700s had time to integrate. And as you might imagine, there's a degree of tension within the community. And there's going to be tension on different kinds of levels. Certainly the Ashkenazi-Sephardic tension, there'll be some class tension, obviously people that are more established versus people that are immigrants. There'll be those tensions, but there'll also be some religious tensions as well, which is what we're going to, which is what we're going to look at. To the extent that there will be a group of people, and we're going to talk about exactly what happens, that form a breakaway, that form this breakaway in 1825. And the, I might say two of the leaders of it are these fellows over here. They seem to have traded the hair of each other. Yeah. And so one of them, his name is John Hart. So Hart is a family that's known in Anglo-Jewish history. And he will be kind of the first president. He'll be the one who kind of like leads it. And the fellow to the right is actually a really interesting figure. His name is Isaac Ber Kershid. Kershid, obviously also an Ashkenazi family. But he's interesting because he's married to the daughter of the late Chazan of Sheretz Israel. The Chazan of Sheretz Israel, Gershom Mendes Seches, known as the Patriot Rabbi, because he supported the revolutionary cause and then marched with George Washington when they, after the war had concluded, was a supporter of the revolution. He was from a Sephardic family that had obviously come to London. His grandfather had actually been in Portugal, had escaped Portugal in the early 1700s through London, and then eventually made the way over to America, which is then where the Seixas family was based. But again, Seixas being a Portuguese type of name. And he was the Chazan there throughout those years. He dies in 1816. So again, you're dealing with a time where, you know, there kind of had been a status quo. The old minister has died. You're dealing with kind of a bit of a vacuum. There'll be a new person, Peshado, who's hired. But it's obviously there's kind of we're entering a new phase within the history of the Sephardic community that's there. And so his son-in-law will be one of the supporters of this group that decides to separate. Now, some of the people will support the separation, but won't necessarily themselves go. And he maintains his affiliation with Sheretz Israel. That's where his family is from, and he remains part of it. The Kershid family actually ends up reconnecting with the Spanish Portuguese even later, because he'll have a son who will eventually settle in New Orleans. Now, New Orleans at that time is kind of like the California of today. You know, it's where you go to get away from religion. You know, it's kind of the West Coast, you know, kind of escape the old world. And there are Jews that are living there that are not particularly religious. His son is religious. His son is an observant Jew. He gets there. He tries to set up a synagogue there. There's already one synagogue there, but it's problematic. He goes to set up another one. I think it's called Nefutzot Yehuda. They set up a synagogue. And he's actually important because he ends up reaching out to a very wealthy Jew that lives in New Orleans, whose name is Judah Turo. Now, Judah Turo is famous because he's incredibly wealthy. His father had been the Chazan in Newport, Rhode Island, at the synagogue, Spanish-Portuguese synagogue there. But his son was not particularly religious and ends up being in New Orleans, but being an incredibly wealthy man. He doesn't have children, he doesn't marry, but he's not particularly invested in the Jewish community until this Kershid kind of befriends him and encourages him to support this new endeavor, and he ends up sponsoring the new synagogue, and then he gets involved, and he ends up coming to Minyan twice a week and keeps Shabbat. He becomes a particularly observant, pious man, to the extent that he ends up giving large donations to Jewish causes upon his death, kind of the first person to do that. He kind of becomes known around the world as kind of, wow, this guy died and gave all his money to important causes. And he ends up teaming up with Moses Montefiore. Now, so this is where the story kind of gets interesting, because he's going to leave, I think it's something like $50,000 towards causes of Jews in the Holy Land, which, you know, Moses Montefiore is incredibly passionate about. And the idea originally was to set up a hospital in the Holy Land. This Kershid will actually go to London to discuss it with Montefiore and then go with him to Israel to kind of try and start this hospital. They get there, and it turns out Rothschild has already started a hospital. So instead, they decide they're going to make housing for people outside of the old city. And they set up a neighborhood that will become known as Yamin Moshe, which is the first Jewish neighborhood that will be built outside the walls of the old city in West Jerusalem, right, which will again pave the way for what we think of today as kind of modern Yerushalayim, modern Jerusalem. While we attribute it to Montefiore, because Montefiore is kind of the person that drove it, the funds actually came from Judah Turo, who was inspired to do that by the son of this Kershit. So the grandson of Gershom Mendes Seixas, the Spanish-Portuguese minister of Sheret Israel. So you see how it's all connected. That's how the world works. It's all connected. Any case, that's a bit of a tangent. So back to our story. So they decide to break away and form this new congregation. Now, but the story behind it, I think, is telling. And that's really kind of the story that I want to tell tonight, because I think it says a lot about the nature of the Jewish community at that time, the challenges that they're facing, and some of the issues that are going on to understand this moment in history. So let's take a look. We're going to look at what they wrote. They wrote a letter to the Ma'amad of Sheret Israel, declaring their intentions. Okay? So I'll read to you the letter that they wrote. So it says the following. It says, to the Parnas and trustees of Kahal Kadosh Erit Yisrael, respected brethren and friends. Whenever you start a letter like that, you know, right? Okay. We are deputed at a committee from a meeting of Israelites held at Washington Hall to announce to you their intention to erect a new synagogue in this city. It is our duty, and we must cheerfully comply with it, to acquaint you with the motives which has induced us to take this step. So they're going to explain why they've done this. We have a large portion of our brethren who have been educated in the German and Polish minhag, who find it difficult to accustom themselves to what is familiarly called the Portuguese minhag, in consequence of their early impressions and habits. It is also proper to state that the increase of our brethren is so great, and all probability will be much greater in a few years, that accommodations, particularly on holidays, cannot be afforded at all to all. Again, the great increase of New York and the distant situation of the shul render it necessary to have a new place of worship and a more convenient situation for those residing uptown. We'll look at the map a little bit later, but Manhattan is expanding uptown. It's no longer just at the bottom tip. These reasons we respectfully trust will be satisfactory to your honorable board, and will at once show our intention is not capriciously to withdraw ourselves from the ancient and respectable congregation of Sheret Israel, which God may prosper, but is urged by motives of necessity. Conforming therefore to our duty as Jews and to the obligation of our holy faith, we first make known our intentions to your board and solicit such aid in the furtherance of this laudable object as liberality, justice, and situation of the congregation warrant. So they're also saying, not only are we leaving, we'd love for you guys to support us. We have the pleasure to state that with loans and subscriptions, we have about $4,000, a sum which your honorable board will at once perceive is insufficient to build a place of worship. It's what we call chutzpah. The religious and the equitable claim which we have as brethren of one great family, the congregation of Sheret Israel, will, we have hope, be recognized, and every aid, accountance, and protection afforded us calculate to ensure success and give respectability and character to our project. Wishing peace to Israel and prosperity and life to you, gentlemen, we are respectfully your friends. And the name of some of the leaders at that time. And so, yes. So here we have over here their letter, essentially stating that why are they setting up a new synagogue? What do you guys say? What did you pick out? Why are they setting up a new synagogue? Oh, sorry, too many voices.
They're Ashkenazim.
Right, Ashkenazim. So they want the Ashkenazim in Hag. And they mentioned another reason as well.
Too many people
and distance. Okay, fine. So those are the reasons that they mention. Okay, now there's a little bit of a story before this story that needs to be told. So this group that eventually starts this synagogue actually started a organization. Again, these were people who had been members of Sheret Israel. So they had previously, in the previous year, started an organization called the Hebra. So very Spanish-Portuguese sounding, called the Hebra Chinuch Ne'arim, the Hebra for the education of the lads. Now, that's an interesting name that they gave it, because essentially what they intended to do as part of this Hebra, and they wrote a letter to the Mahamad indicating as such, is that they wanted to start an early minyan on Shabbat mornings at the synagogue. And this minyan would be run by themselves. And was not supposed to be under, in a sense, it was going to be part of Sherith Israel, but it would be also have a degree of autonomy within Sherith Israel as well. Now, what exactly did they claim to want to do with this? So I'll read to you the following. It says, this is what their constitution that they had written said. They said that the Hebra's formation is because, and here I quote, of an ardent desire to promote the study of our holy law, right? So education, and to extend a knowledge of its divine precepts, ceremonies, and worship among our brethren generally, and the inquiring youth in particular, right? So again, this idea of wanting to teach. But really, what they ended up wanting to do was they wanted to insist on the following. They wanted to set up the separate minyan, which interestingly was going to be for the Ashkenazim, but they weren't so audacious to say they would follow the Ashkenazi minhag. It would still follow the Sephardic rite. Maybe they would do Ashkenazi pronunciations for the Sephardic prayer book. They tried to kind of find some type of accommodation. And they also, and this is really telling, they said anybody that attends this minyan needs to be Shomer Shabbat. Which means that not everyone who's going to Sherith Israel was Shomer Shabbat. And it seemed that they were troubled by the mixture of people who were going to Sherith Israel at this time, right, of different religious observances, and therefore wanted to essentially have their own minyan, where their children would be raised only amongst other people that were fully observant, where there would be regular lectures during the service to explain, to educate the children, and that they would have a degree of autonomy over that particular service. And what this tells us is that there was a religious divide in the community, not just between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, but between perhaps a religiously heterodox community coming from the 1700s and this, at least what at first seems to be, this more religiously homogeneous group of the newly arrivals from Central Europe. And that they were uncomfortable praying with people of different religious observances and wanted to have their own minyan. Now, the reason I think that this is significant is that I think it draws into doubt a little bit their original, what they write later as their reason for leaving the synagogue. Because you could claim, okay, they did ideally want to have a Ashkenazi minhag. Maybe that was really what they would have wanted originally. But they end up setting the synagogue uptown because, hey, it's too far. I mean, I guess not too far. They originally were willing to go to the synagogue. In fact, I'll show you how far it was. I had to figure this out a little bit by using old maps. The synagogue was set up on a street called Elm Street, which doesn't exist anymore. So here, I can show you a little bit. So this is a map of Lower Manhattan. And what we have over here, this is South William Street, originally Mill Street. There's a little alley off of Mill Street, which used to be known as Jews Alley, because that was kind of the little area where the Jews would hang out. That's where the original synagogue was, and that's where they built the second Mill Street synagogue. And this on Lafayette Street, which originally was Elm Street, is where they set up their synagogue. Okay, this is where they ended up setting up their synagogue in this area. And it was renamed Lafayette. Lafayette was the general of the French fleet that blockaded the British troops by Yorktown, I think it is. And it's really because of the French that the Americans defeated. How could the Americans have defeated the British, you know, military? It was because the French helped them. And so Lafayette was a real hero. And so I think sometime in like the 1820s or something like that, 1830s, he kind of did like a tour back of like, you know, the Americas and was like, you know, celebrated throughout. So maybe after that, that's when they renamed the street Lafayette. In any case, it's over there. It's about a mile from Sherith Israel, so not really very far. You remember that in London, and we'll talk about this in our next session, there was a rule at Bevis Marks that you couldn't build a second synagogue within 5 or 6 miles of Bevis Marks. I mean, they expected if you lived 4 miles away, you still would be walking. I mean, here we're not actually dealing with such a far distance away from where the synagogue had been. But that's where they're going to set up
their synagogue.
So it's not like it was this incredibly, oh my gosh, look how far uptown we are. There's no way we can go to synagogue there. They were willing to go to synagogue there. And so what seems is that their desire to break away was actually a little bit more complex. Now, what's particularly interesting is that Cherith Israel doesn't seem to have really been so sad to let them go. What will happen in 1825 is the board of Cherith Israel will pass a following motion after doing some looking into the legality of things. Essentially, the rules were as such after, I think, 1789 with the new constitution that, and it has to do with kind of how religious institutions are incorporated and how people become members, is that essentially the way it used to work is that if you had been going to a religious house of worship for a year, that at that point, you then were eligible to become a member. And that essentially, until this time, it was a thing that was, you know, kind of you had the right to do, that, you know, you've been there for a year, you join, and that was it. What the Board of Cherith Israel will discover is that actually it doesn't have to be automatic. It's not that after a year you can join as a member, it's that after a year you become eligible to become a member, but your membership still has to be approved by the pre-existing membership, and that it's a private club, not that everyone has the right to join. You can realize how different this is than the way things had been in the old world. In the old world, if you were a Jew, you had to be a member of the Jewish community. You were governed by the Jewish community without any choice. All of a sudden you're dealing with America where there's separation of church and state, where now it's not only that you don't have to be in the Jewish community, you don't even have the right to be in the Jewish community if the Jewish community doesn't want you in the Jewish community. And apparently at that board meeting that year, 16 people applied for to become Yechidim, to become members, and only two of them got approval. Which is clear, or seems to be, that they were concerned that if all these people become members, that their Hashkama Minyan would eventually take over the synagogue, and that eventually they would probably make Cherith Israel into a Polish Minhag. Now, I don't know if that's a reasonable concern. Maybe, I don't know we don't know for sure that that is necessarily what they were concerned about, but they clearly did want all these people becoming members. And I think they saw the increase in numbers, and I think they took the attitude and saying, fine, go start another synagogue. You don't see the fights that we'll learn about next in our next class about trying to make sure they don't leave and trying to compel them to come back. It's kind of like, okay, and that's why it's actually a very pleasant letter, because it's actually a mutual understanding that it's time for them to go their separate ways. Now, I look at this a little bit, and I think it was a bit of a lost opportunity that the community had, because they really did make a mistake in 1818 building their synagogue on the location of the original synagogue. Because New York was expanding and people were starting to move uptown. In fact, in 1834, Cherith Israel will build its third synagogue on Crosby Street, which is the top point over there. So just about a mile and a half north of where their original building had been, and even a little further north than where the breakaway synagogue had been. And that's where they're going to set up their next synagogue. The old synagogue will be sold. They don't keep their synagogues as they move. They actually got rid of them one by one as they moved uptown. And that's where they'll set up. So they clearly misjudged. And it could be that if they had originally set up another synagogue uptown, maybe this influx would have remained under the umbrella, or maybe there would have been some broader partnership and the Jewish community would have been unified, but as well, the community actually divides. And they will kind of set up their own institutions at the new synagogue, their own mikveh, their own school. It really kind of then operates a lot of the way that it operated here in London, where the Sephardic community was kind of a world unto itself, and the Ashkenazi community was to a large degree a world unto itself, right? Almost as if you had two cities within one city, as it were, right? Because again, they're all operating on the old model that the synagogue runs all of these functions. Not the way we do today, where you have the synagogue doing one thing and then you have other institutions doing other things independent of the synagogues. I mean, you still have that a bit in England, actually, right? Because the schools, a lot of them are run by the United Synagogue and so on. So you actually still have that a bit in the way it's functioned, but certainly not in America. You don't have it functioning that way anymore. Things are really, each one is independent. I mean, the irony is that there will be more and more Jews moving to New York. soon there will be a breakaway from B'nai Jeshurun called Anshei Chesed, and then there will be a breakaway from Anshei Chesed that will become known as, it's a famous synagogue now on the Upper East Side. It's in all the TV shows and movies.
Park East.
Not Park East, it's, I'm blanking on the name. In any case, it'll be breakaway off of this and a breakaway from the breakaway and a breakaway from the breakaway. There'll be tons of synagogues that are gonna kind of launch in New York in the years after this. What to me is interesting, and this we're gonna kind of look at, is this issue of what's going on religiously within this, because clearly there's a feeling of that the original Spanish Portuguese are perhaps not religious enough, and they wanna have a more orthodox type of surrounding. Do they think of it as being more Ashkenaz? I don't know. The ultimate irony is that B'nai Jeshurun is a massive conservative synagogue on the Upper West Side, you know, that has, you know, famous for their musical Kabbalat Shabbat with guitars and musicians and dancing. I mean, it's a major thing. So they don't remain Orthodox for too long. But I guess, but that is definitely their original impetus.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
How come you felt that the Spanish and Portuguese could have controlled the initial stage, that expansion, and stopped those breakaways? I mean,
because many
breakaways.
No, eventually.
Eventually it was not going to happen.
I guess what could have happened is there could have been a way for maybe the community to remain house more unified. And essentially everybody kind of goes their own separate ways. And it is possible that there could have been some type of, maybe not forever. I mean, obviously there's millions of Jews in New York now. It wasn't going to last. But maybe it would have been a little bit different. But I think they were happy not to. And again, some of them have been coming from London, so they have this model and say, okay, so there'll be different communities. But then the communities are different. They're separate. You know, and that's where there was kind of, we'll see in the next lesson when we talk about London, that's what made West London so complicated, is because it was new, but it wasn't completely separate. They were relatives and all these charity boards. It was a real mess. It was a real complication. There, they were kind of like, fine, so you leave, do your own thing. Now, the communities did remain friendly. We know that people went, when they stopped in the new building, they went to celebrate, they lent them Torahs for the celebration. They would announce when people had died from the different communities, they would announce them in the other synagogues. So there still kind of remained a sense of friendship between the communities in the years afterwards. But let's just take a look. This is really what I kind of want to focus on for the last part of it a bit. So as I mentioned, this is the fellow up here. This is Gerashimen de Seixas. So he was the minister until 1816. Again, so he dies, and you can imagine kind of that the minister has died. There's an influx of people. People are moving uptown. It's suddenly a time of things are being in flux in there. But there's a bit more that's going on. I think this is kind of interesting about some of the tensions, and it relates a little bit to Hamburg, because I want to show you what this fellow writes. This is Mordechai Manuel Noe. He is the most famous Jew in America in the first half of the 19th century. He'll be the first Jew appointed to a public office. He'll become the ambassador to Tunis until he's recalled, because they'll feel that him being Jewish is actually complicating his ability to serve. He's very upset about that. He writes that, no, I did my job, irrespective of the fact that I'm Jewish and it didn't impact it at all. In any case, he's famous. He's a playwright. He's a public speaker. He's an editor. He has newspapers. He's a very famous person in America at that time. Prolific. He writes quite a lot. And he will give a speech at the establishment of the synagogue in 1818. He'll give a speech at the Crosby Street when that's built. And so he's an important figure. And what's interesting is what he writes over here. This is in 1818, okay? So this is really kind of early on. And he writes the following. He says, "Who is he that can amend them? Once encroach upon their connections, once impair or affect their essence, once innovate upon their principles, and who can say where it will end? What dangers may not arise? What destruction may not be anticipated?" Anybody guess what he's talking about?
Changing the minhag,
right? Changing it. Now, this may already be a reference to the reform in Germany, right? Where he's kind of giving this speech and saying, we built this new synagogue, but don't think about making any changes, right? Because who can make changes? Once you make some, once you do one thing, then, you know, one thing will lead to the next, right? And he kind of takes that approach of saying, you know, you have to be really strict with holding on to things. Now, if he's giving that speech, presumably there's people that are maybe agitating for change. And so he's giving the speech against change. The irony is in 1834, he'll give a speech saying they should change a lot of things. So he, and then in the 1840s, he'll give another speech saying that you shouldn't. So he flip-flops a bunch on this issue. But he's keenly aware of the changes that are taking place. He's actually famous. He's a proto-Zionist. He will actually establish a Jewish colony in America, which is meant to be a place where Jews can go to learn agriculture in anticipation of eventually moving to the Holy Land and setting up what he imagines will be a Jewish state there one day. Where does he set up? And he writes letters to Europe inviting Jews. Again, these are the years during this upheaval after Napoleon where he thinks, okay, there's going to be people looking for places to go. We'll send them to this colony. He purchases land outside of Buffalo. Now, someone who grew up in that area, the winters are not nice. And nobody actually goes. But he actually sets it up and he has like senators come. It's like a big celebration when he like purchases this piece of land called, which he calls Ararat. He's an interesting character. He's a really interesting figure. His painting hangs in the entranceway to Sheretz Israel, this painting that you see over here. But he's aware of things that are going on. So he's aware of the people that want to change. And again, it could be that some of these people who are new to the synagogue, they're maybe hearing some people in the synagogue saying, oh, you know, we should make changes, we should shorten the service, and maybe that's why they leave. Or maybe he knows there's people who want to introduce Ashkenazi things, and that's what he's referring to. You know, and saying we have to preserve the minhag. So what you actually start finding during this time is the beginning of what I would call Portuguese Orthodoxy, where you have this kind of incredible like commitment to saying we do not change a thing. The minhag is the minhag, and you don't dare touch it. Because there's this great fear that if you start touching it, then the whole minhag is lost. And it's really interesting because you don't find references to the minhag in that way in the 1700s. It's really an 1800s phenomenon, and then obviously we find it until our very day. So it seems that you start having this kind of like militant commitment to minhag once it starts feeling like, well, it could get lost. And so you then really want to hold on tightly. And once you have people of other customs or other attitudes, that's when it becomes a challenge and you kind of have to take that approach. When everyone's just Portuguese in the 1700s or everyone's committed to that, there's obviously no real concern about what it can possibly be. So in any case, so he makes this speech. It gives us a sense of what's going on, that there are these concerns within the community. In fact, there'll be a letter which is sent to New York in 1841 from London to New York, and they're going to write from New York this response to London. In this response, you can see what London had originally written to the leaders of Sheretz Israel in New York. And he writes the following. He says, "To this time, we have in our congregation steered clear of the rock of innovation. The most trifling or immaterial has not been permitted in our public worship, fearful that it might afford argument for farther and more important alteration. No sooner shall their authors have passed from this transitory life than a new set, coming into power and fancying themselves wiser than their predecessors, must of course substitute their plan of public worship. Let any of us arriving from almost any part of the world meet, we feel ourselves at home and join in the service of the synagogue on any day, at any time, even to the different tunes." And so here they promote this idea of, you know, kind of this anti-reform stance. Obviously, London is written to them because they've just had a breakaway from Bevis Marks saying, don't let this happen to you guys in New York. And they're writing back and saying, don't worry, we got things under control here. And true, if you go to Sheretz Israel today, they're incredibly strict about the minhag even to this very day, perhaps because they actually did have moments in their history where there were agitations within the community to adopt certain reform practices, which is perhaps for another time. But this will be something that is tearing at the Jewish community. There's all kinds of pulls that are going on. And those are the pressures that the community is going to be feeling in the 1800s. As you get immigration, more Jews moving to these places, as you get people hearing about reform ideas from Germany, and people saying, hey, some of those sound like great ideas. People will be moving to new areas, saying, hey, we can't walk this synagogue anymore. We need new synagogues. And so these original established communities are going to start feeling the pressures of these different movements starting to pull them in different directions. And in some situations, it will pull the communities apart. sometimes quite painfully, and other times, like seems to happen in New York, in an amicable way, where there's kind of this respectful parting of the ways, and they say, fine, you go your way, we'll go our way. To me, the irony is that Cherith Israel, which they seem to think wasn't religious enough, is still, as a synagogue, you know, we might call it Orthodox synagogue, B'nai Jeshurun, which kind of was this ardent Orthodox, you know, eventually became a conservative synagogue, which to me, I think, speaks about the strength of the Spanish and Portuguese, that it's structured in such a way that it's obviously as a institution committed to tradition, to halakha, but it's also respectful of people's personal choices as well. And it's allowed the community to maintain its identity as a traditional community and the aspiration that that's what a person should aspire to, but at the same time, if someone doesn't feel up to that challenge, up to fulfilling those responsibilities, it doesn't mean that they have to leave the community. It's actually kept the community together for centuries through that attitude. And so I think we actually see in this fight, something that I would see is kind of this, something that really becomes a classic part of the Spanish and Portuguese, this kind of Sephardic tradition, which is, not compromising on their principles, but also being respectful of people making their own choices. That wasn't necessarily the case in the 1700s. We know that in 1700s, they excommunicated people in New York who had their stores open on Shabbat. And, so it's obviously not, the Spanish Portuguese weren't always this tolerant, this tolerant bunch, but certainly this kind of attitude of saying, there's value in the sense of community. And it doesn't mean just because you have a different ideology, that means you have to go open your own synagogue, to do that. But we can actually all be in the same community, even if we're doing somewhat different things. And I think you kind of see that already by the early 1800s, that struggle with how do you maintain your identity, but still be accepting of people that are different from you, and people who are uncomfortable with that approach to building a synagogue, and that that actually frays the community and people go in different directions. What I like about this story, even though it doesn't relate directly to reform, I think this story is really reflective of the things that are happening in the Jewish world. As I mentioned, immigration, people moving to new neighborhoods, questions about change, questions about minhag, people from different areas now living together and figuring out, so what should their community now look like? The aspiration to maintain identity, the aspiration to create a space for people that are different to be in the same building. All those things are kind of at play within this. So without any judgment of, should Cherith Israel have permitted them to open up a synagogue in the basement? Should they have originally built their Crosby Street synagogue, which is in this plate below, not in 1834, but in 1818? It's hard when science challenges face us. We make the decisions we make.
Same discussion 15 years ago in Lauderdale. Exactly the same.
But another synagogue, that type of idea?
With the Minyan.
Oh, with Minyanics, with Minyan in the building.
They were more religious than us, and they wanted initially their own Minyan, and we said, no, they're too religious for us, and then they went off and set up their own
synagogue. Right, and so there's kind of like this piece, okay, you know what? I don't know. I mean, I wasn't here then, so I can't comment on that. But these are kind of issues. And that's what I'm saying, that this moment in history is very similar to our own. It's a really similar moment to our own time in history. And that's what I find so enriching about reading and learning about this time, is that I think it actually gives us a lot of insight into our own time and makes us reflective about the kind of issues that we face even, in the Jewish community today that perhaps can be informative towards the choices that we make in our communities nowadays, and how we grapple with immigration and change and neighborhoods and all of those kinds of issues. That is a story of how New York went from being a Spanish and Portuguese city to being, well, first Ashkenazi and then Spanish, and then eventually an Ashkenazi city with a Spanish and Portuguese synagogue. But it is part of that transition that takes place from the Kehillah model, from the synagogue city model, to many synagogues in a city, which really will change the face of what the Jewish world will look like, because that will become what we find in Jewish communities across the Western world, where you will have many synagogues that will be across the city, and you won't have any more synagogues as institutions the way that they had been in the medieval times or in the early modern times. And right, so this really shows what we'd spoken about last week about that this is a, you know, we think of, you know, the 1700s and 1600s as kind of already modern times, but in certain ways they're still very medieval. It's really in the 1800s that you kind of start having these new models, you know, these separation of church and state, Jews as citizens and things like that, the structure of many synagogues in a city that will really be part of the modern world and part of the modern Jewish world, which is, I think, more familiar to us today. So thank you all so much for coming. Our next series is going to be, lecture will be, I believe it's the 14th of June, something like that, and it will be about West London synagogue, so I look forward to that. Yeah, David.
What happened to the new Sephardim that came into New York, and how did that linkage work with Charity Israel?
When?
Was the Syrian?
Well, obviously there was the Syrians, but there may have been other Sephardim that came.
So it depends. There were some Sephardic Jews that came to New York already in the kind of in the